Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and I got my brother co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr., and we are bringing back to the podcast Dr. Grant Tinsley. He is a body composition measurement expert. He has his own lab. He does studies all in the realm of body composition. So welcome back, Grant.
Thanks for having me back. Happy to chat with you all again.
I wonder if people, before we even start, they're going to see the title of this, but so they're already going to know what we're going to harp on. But
we might as well call this the Peter Attia Hater podcast.
Because I know, and there's no way he listens to it, but no. I swear we're not targeting Peter Attia. It just happens to be that he's brought up some things recently that are not exactly appropriate, and we need to address them.
Yeah.
From our perspective, yeah. Someone's got to address so it seems like we're piling on poor Peter Attia, although he's not poor by any means of the imagination.
Not even close. So, okay, we had Grant on before to talk about his study of looking at home body fat scales, and he went through some of how you actually measure body composition. We're going to do kind of a review of how to measure body composition using different methods. But recently we also did a quick podcast on this concern of lean body mass loss with GLP-1s. But now we wanted to bring Grant on to kind of discuss this. We aren't experts in body composition analysis. We understand it enough to make clinical recommendations and things like that and understand it clinically. But we wanted to kind of get into the nitty gritty with Grant here. So
yeah, because, well, first of all, I don't know anybody else who really is a body composition analysis expert like Grant.
Who is?
Like, because all these people talking about this, all of us clinicians and a lot of researchers don't really know the nuances in the weeds of body composition, but they take the results of some of these tests and then they start extrapolating and some of it's reasonable, right? I mean, when we talk about basic body composition for our patients, fine, whatever. But when we start making some of these big jumps and I don't know, people are taking some of these conclusions to extremes that are inappropriate.
We want an expert that can go much more into detail than we could. So here was the claim. So we already talked about this before. Peter brought up on his blog this concern. We did a podcast a month or so ago about close to a 40% lean body mass loss seen with semaglutide use, and whether it was in the study of obesity and those with type 2 diabetes, either the Wegovy version, which is the high dose semaglutide 2.4 versus the Ozempic version, which at the time I believe only went up to 1 milligram, and shows in both studies looks like it was up to a 38-39% lean body mass loss, which is more than what we'd expect. You generally want it to be somewhere between 20-30% if you're not doing resistance training. We'd actually want it lower if you're doing resistance training.
But there's always lean mass loss in all weight loss interventions.
In general,
diet, surgery,
and we're going to have Grant supported. Talk about that too.
and of course, and then the other thing is these were relatively small subsets from the studies, you know, using the metrics that they had. And there were some real interesting, you know, the other arms, the placebo were goofy.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. But okay, so here's the most recent claim. Peter was on the Megyn Kelly show. Whatever you think about Megyn Kelly, I don't really care.
I've always been a big fan.
Okay. He made the claim, and they might have spliced this, where they might have, I don't know how they got on this topic, but he made the claim that one of his patients lost weight, and 2/3 of that weight was lean body mass loss. And he said that this person's getting lighter, but they're getting fatter. That's what he said on the on the little clip. And now, because I'm a social media light and I'm talking about GLP-1 medicines all the time, I'm getting pinged. I had to make a video response about this, but I'm getting pinged all over the place that, see, this guy's doing studies and found that it's mostly lean mass loss. I'm like, first of all, we have they actually have done studies and shown
real studies.
Real studies.
Not just like an anecdotal stuff.
And before we get into the nitty gritty with Grant, Grant's just sitting here listening,
looking at us like idiots.
I did a poll. Smile and nod. So with my program sequence, we have, I can say this publicly because it's been posted publicly, we have over 20,000 patients on these medicines. I've never seen the signal. Now, we don't get DEXAs on everybody, but many of them do get DEXA scans. Many of them do in-bodies, and we'll talk about this with Grant again because he talked about this. And then some of them do get BOD pods. I've never once seen a signal. I polled all my patients and followers on social media. They were sending me DEXAs and in-bodies left and right, and nowhere near. The highest one that I saw was close to what the study showed. They showed a 38% lean body mass, and we'll talk about this with Grant. This person, though, got substantially stronger over that time. So we're going to get into how that could be.
Well, you know, and also just to recall, we talked about this on the other podcast. When we talk about weight, when we talk about the disease of obesity, it is not just about the weight. It's not about even just the amount of fat. Right? It's about what harm is the fat doing. And so these medications, they were obviously approved for type 2 diabetes first. They have outstanding glycemic benefits. They have cardiovascular benefits. They have renal benefits. They have fatty liver benefits. So when people with obesity, and especially at high risk or especially with complications, the clinical conditions improve. That's the most important thing. Yeah. So now we're starting to have people scare people away from the medications that have actual clinical benefit because of this somewhat manufactured concern of excess lean mass loss. Yeah. So that's the context.
All right, Grant, we sent you all the data. You took a look at it. Give us your just initial thoughts of everything, and I'll start asking you more questions.
Yeah, so again, in the studies, I'll make one comment from the outset just so I don't forget. You all know this, I'm sure many of your listeners do, but as you mentioned, an anecdote with a sample size of one is not the same as a study. And also, if you recall, we might have even gotten to this on the last podcast, typically the error for one individual with a body composition assessment method, whatever it is much higher than the group error. So when we talk about, you know, even though it is a smaller subsample, if we have, you know, like 40 to 90 people in some of these groups, we'll talk about some of those random errors that would kind of inflate or deflate changes you'd see, some of those get canceled out. So I'm actually not particularly surprised that, you know, someone could find an anecdote where it looked like there was this extreme lean mass loss, because you're looking at one individual with no context. If we're not even getting into standardization, if there were several things that were different about when they did their first scan, let's say even it's DEXA, I'm not sure if it was DEXA or not, or if he shared, but say it was DEXA. Okay. So if there were different protocols, say the individual was overnight fasted or essentially fasted, came in early in the morning for one scan, the other scan, maybe they came in during the afternoon for scheduling availability, what have you, that alone could induce several kilos of changes in some of these compartments. In addition to the fact, whenever you're assessing one person, the error rates are larger. It's possible that person is kind of like dead on the average error you'd see, but it's very possible they're an outlier in one another direction. So point being, as you all know, we shouldn't base too much on a sample size of one with no documentation of the methods or context or how large were these changes or anything like that.
So that's good to know.
So that's kind of a side note. But so in terms of the studies themselves, would you just like a...
Go over the numbers. I sent them to you because I'm like, am I missing something here?
Yeah, so I'll say, a few components. One thing I'll mention is this is based on, you know, a series of papers dating back, I guess, a couple decades. Some of these were by Stephen Hamesfield, is a giant in the area of body composition. I've been fortunate to work with him on a couple papers here in the last year or two. And then more recently, this kind of idea I'm about to talk about was sort of rediscussed by Jeremy Lenicky, who's another great researcher in this area. But this concept I mentioned is that with large weight losses, there are kind of some considerations we need to look at where we could have lean mass losses. Even if all the procedures are performed correctly, we might have lean mass losses. They're a little bit inflated relative to what actual truth is. And one reason for that is that even though adipose tissue is, you know, storing lipid and has very high lipid content in adipocytes, there are non-fat components. So there is some amount of water content and protein content in these adipocytes. So as they shrink with weight loss, we're losing some of those non-lipid components as well. Some of the small amount of water that was stored with lipid. This is not the same amount as like stored with glycogen. We know, you know, storing a gram of glycogen will store that with about 3 grams of water. It's not nearly that much for lipid, but you do lose some water, lose some protein as you're losing this lipid. So there's some math to kind of correct lean mass losses for the, what we call, what I'm describing is the fat-free component of adipose tissue. So the fact that adipose tissue is not 100% lipid. So when you do these corrections, it's based on kind of assumed average that about 85% of adipose tissue would actual fat, like stored triglyceride. So you can run some corrections, but essentially if you do that, it usually reduces the amount of lean mass that is reported. So you sent over those studies and I took a look at them. So the semaglutide, for my pronunciation.
Semaglutide. You can, for this podcast, you could say Ozempic Wegovy.
It doesn't matter.
It's much easier. So for there, in that group, for example, the reported lean mass loss was right around 7 kilograms, like 6.92 kilograms. If you did this correction, which is just simple math, and this is published in Obesity Journal, it's been published in journals prior to that, but just this simple correction to try to account for some of that fat-free component from adipose tissue, not from other lean mass that was lost, it takes that lean mass loss down to right about 5 kilograms. So mm-hmm. that knocks off about 2 kilograms. It doesn't completely wipe this out, saying like, you know, lean mass was lost. But that's a relatively large reduction.
That's significant.
That's very significant for what, especially for the statistics that they're like, you know, concerned about, or at least that they're scaring people about.
Yep. And then similarly, we're, you know, chatting offline just before we started recording, but even the placebo group had some mm-hmm. lean mass loss, about 1.5 kilos. That correction takes that down to minus 0.2 kilograms. So essentially nothing. So essentially levels that out. And then similarly, I don't know if you want to go trial by trial, but the similar things were seen in the other trial you sent as well.
Tirzepatide.
Yeah. Yes. So in that study, it's a little more interesting because those lean mass losses were much smaller. Yeah. So it actually, this correction completely wiped them out. So in the primary group where there was 1.6 kilos lost, the correction made it to a gain of 0.1 kilos. So essentially no change once you've done that correction. The placebo group, it didn't change because there was no change in fat-free mass in this case, in that group. But the semaglutide that had lost almost a kilo, it came out to a gain of 0.2 kilograms. So in some cases, like when there are the smaller losses, it might wipe out that loss completely by employing mm-hmm. this correction. In the large losses, it doesn't wipe it out completely, but reduces the magnitude. And this is not a perfect correction, but again, it's based on the fact we know we are losing components of adipose tissue that beyond just the fat itself.
That's really interesting.
And that's Jeremy Lenneke. He had a paper out a few years ago and kind of discussing that. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so can you explain, because we were talking about how the one study I sent you, they used BOD pod. And can you explain how you even get, again, I know we did the podcast before, but for those listening and for me, how do you get muscle mass from a DEXA scan?
So the real answer is you don't.
Right.
You're setting me up nicely for that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So DEXA is a great technique. It's a precise technique, a relatively valid technique. You can estimate skeletal muscle. So I'll start from the beginning. Yeah. So we put someone on a DEXA scanner. We're scanning them. I think for any method, it's important to realize we are measuring something, but then we're using some like conversions and assumptions to get to what we're actually interested in, which is body composition. We have to estimate that because we can't, in living humans, truly measure body composition. We can't dissect them physically or chemically while they're, you know, alive.
Not preferable.
No. So we lay someone down. We're essentially shooting x-rays of different energies through them. We're looking at how that x-ray energy is attenuated or kind of reduced as it passes through different body tissues. And from that, for DEXA, there are kind of two main comparisons that are being used. It's kind of finding pixels in this 2D image that's being created, pixels that contain bone versus those that don't contain bone. And then within those that don't contain bone, it's looking at lean mass pixels and fat mass pixels. And in this case, we're not talking about like skeletal muscle and adipose tissue. We're just talking about molecules in the body. It's like molecules of lean, molecules of fat, we know that those attenuate these x-rays differently, and that's what we're basing this on. But ultimately, we get this 2D image with pixels that are either bone or some proportion of lean and fat. So if we have what's reported, it's often called lean body mass. So like in the study you sent, they're calling it lean body mass. A little bit better term would be lean soft tissue. So soft tissue meaning non-bone, and lean meaning non-fat. So all the tissue that is not fat and not bone is included in there. So water, for example, is included in lean soft tissue from DEXA. So lean soft tissue includes, you know, there's a lot of overlap with muscle. We could do the same thing with muscle. Muscle is mostly fat-free mass. It has a little bit of lipid content, but most of muscle would be included in that lean soft tissue compartment. So when they're reporting all these lean mass changes, that lean soft tissue, though, it has the water wherever it is in the body. So like most of, and protein as well. So like most of organ content, glycogen, so carbohydrate stores would be included in this, which I think is important, especially if you're going on a weight loss program where you could have some changes in early changes in like glycogen and water stores that would show up in the lean mass compartment on DEXA. So you can't truly get skeletal muscle. There are equations, which they probably would have been helpful for them to use here. There are equations based on the appendicular lean mass. So just the lean mass you're seeing in the arms and legs, where you can plug those into equations that were developed using MRI, which can assess skeletal muscle. You can plug them into these equations and get an estimate of skeletal muscle. And the reason we do that is because there's a lot going on in the trunk in terms of fat-free mass that is not skeletal muscle, not necessarily what we're interested in. So the organ mass, for example, is something that could be complicated here because you can have changes in organ mass with like substantial weight loss like this. Mm-hmm. So that kind of confuses the trunk. So several series of equations just use appendicular lean mass from DEXA to predict skeletal muscle. I would personally be curious to see those data from these trials. If they had reported that, it would have been kind of a nice.
Yeah, they probably have that data.
Maybe. Yeah, they definitely do. So probably, maybe not in the trial, but definitely on the DEXA report someone, that spits it out. So
someone has it. We should.
Maybe we should. Yeah, maybe we need to.
We got to have Grant pioneer this, I think. We'll make it happen, actually. Keep going. We'll talk offline.
So, I mean, I can pause there to see what direction you want to go. But for DEXA, that's what we're getting. Lean soft tissue, sometimes called lean body mass, has some relationship with skeletal muscle, but is not directly equivalent.
That's what I wanted you that's what I wanted you to explain. So when somebody loses lean, but when it shows a loss of lean body mass, it's not necessarily muscle. Is that what you're saying? The assumption is that a lot of it is, it could be muscle, but it doesn't necessarily mean it could be water changes.
Yes. I mean, it is, it's definitely all the things above, right? I mean, it's definitely they're losing something, a lot of water, right? Fair amount of water.
Could be.
Yeah, so really the lean mass, anything that is not bone, mineral, or molecules of fat is included in lean mass. So yeah, the water, some amount of, this won't apply to DEX as much, some amount of free-floating mineral, which you don't need to worry about, it's very small here, but glycogen, certainly protein itself, whether that's in skeletal muscle or within organs or elsewhere.
Okay. Yeah. And then when you do a BOD pod, explain that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so big picture, there are similarities in the variables you're getting. So you'll ultimately get fat mass and fat-free mass. Mm-hmm. So here we're not looking at bone specifically. So in this case, we'll have an estimate of molecules of fat and molecules of everything else, which would include bone in this case. The principles that are used, very different. So DEX, again, imaging technology, this is based on, like we're creating these pixels based on attenuation of x-rays at specific locations. Again, this is produced as an image. BOD pod, in contrast, for those who you haven't seen it, when we bring someone in and do a BOD pod in our lab, we weigh them on a calibrated scale in minimal form-fitting clothing. We have them enter this chamber. So they sit in a sealed chamber. So they're sitting in a chamber of air. There's another separate chamber of air behind them. And the two chambers are connected by a little diaphragm. And that diaphragm will oscillate and cause slight changes in the pressure and volume in these two different air compartments. And based on that, based on that relationship and just pressure-volume relationships, we can estimate the volume of that person's body. And we go through a lot of calibration. It takes 15 to 30 minutes to calibrate the BOD pods. We have a cylinder. We know exactly how big it is. We put it in. We calibrate it, make sure everything is operating correctly. But ultimately, we can get the volume and the density of the body. So from there, and BOD pod, for anyone familiar with older techniques, it's just kind of a slightly more modern version of underwater weighing or hydrostatic weighing.
That's what we did back in my day.
Yep.
I did that once. That's what we did.
Yeah, relatively similar principles, though. We just know there's a different density, essentially, of fat-free mass and fat mass. So we can kind of use all this information to estimate from these kind of old equations, estimate fat-free mass and fat mass. So,
which is pretty good, right? I mean, the like you said, that's pretty well validated, generally relatively consistent.
It is a pretty good method. All these methods, again, still, you know, what I mentioned about in an individual, it's difficult. There are some limitations really of both of these. A big one is water, which we've touched on a little bit, but neither of these are accounting for water specifically. So they all have these assumptions. BODPOD, for example, it assumes that everyone's fat-free mass is about 73% water. But we know from cadaver analysis and like other in vivo studies that it actually varies from person to person. That's a good population average, but certain populations of athletes or maybe weight reduced people, different groups will have a different proportion of their fat-free mass as water. So if you have a whole population you're assessing who varies on that characteristic, you could kind of have systematic error in your fat-free mass estimates or individual error. If you're someone who just has different fat-free mass properties than these population averages, you might have a pretty inaccurate assessment with one of these two compartment models like BODPOD that are splitting all of your body mass into just fat mass or fat-free mass. But with all that said, it is viewed as a relatively good method. It's just not perfect, and no individual method is.
Okay. So just to go back on that, I did send you a study where they compared semaglutide 1 milligram to tirzepatide, I believe, up to 15 milligrams. And they looked at, they didn't do a DEXA, so we can't really compare that, but they did use BODPOD, I believe, in the analyses. And it looked like relatively low for both of them, low amounts of lean body mass loss, if I'm remembering that.
What was your interpretation of that subset?
It was like a phase one. It was a phase one study because I think they were looking at strictly appetite and changes in caloric intake, and it was a very short study, right? Because it was phase one.
It wasn't a subset of the the phase three semaglutide.
No, I don't believe so. I believe it was phase one, if I'm thinking correctly. It doesn't totally matter, but like it was relatively small. But I just remember going, oh, did they use DEXA in this one? Because I was trying to go down this rabbit hole. I'm like, no, he used BODPOD. That's interesting. Okay.
Yes, I would say comparing across those two studies, I think how, because you're right, the amount of lean mass loss is very small in that study using BODPOD. I would feel relatively comfortable saying that I think some amount of that discrepancy between the studies must be due to the body composition assessment method.
Okay.
I don't know how much this has been characterized. This is certainly not my area of expertise, but if there are other effects of these pharmaceuticals on body water stores, for example, that's certainly something that could affect these technologies differently as like an imaging technology or a density-based technology. With that said, even though there was small lean mass loss, as I mentioned, if you employed this correction we discussed, it essentially wiped it out where every group was between 0 and plus 0.2 kilograms fat-free mass. If you employed that correction. I would say the methods definitely played a role there. This would probably be, if there's sort of uncertain effects of these pharmaceuticals on components that would relate to the validity of the body composition devices. This is just me showing my research bias.
Yeah, no.
It would be great if someone could run a study where they're using multiple common methods of use clinically and seeing like, are there effects of this pharmaceutical that are causing these body composition changes to track differently depending on if we're using BODPOD or DEXA or like a bioimpedance scale that, you know, some clinic may have.
So anecdotally, a lot of people have done the in-body because that's what they have. Those, and you can describe the in-body, the bioimpedance, but those showed very little with, you know, hundreds of people sent me their in-bodies. They're like, I didn't lose any muscle according to my in-bodies. And maybe you can do a quick thing here. And then and after we talk about that, I want to say, like, if you were trying to measure literally muscle loss, what would you do as a researcher? But before we do that, kind of discuss the in-body, what everybody sees. And we kind of did this on the last podcast because there's a similar method to what you use at home on your scales. But most people are using in-bodies because I think they're at the gyms and whatever.
Yes. So first I'll say that just the places that have in-bodies, yeah, they're at gyms, they're in supplement stores and so on. It's another time you have to have heightened awareness of standardization because bioimpedance can be a good technology, but it is very sensitive to prior exercise, food and fluid intake, and so on. So if you're listening to this and you want to use InBody, that's fine. I'd recommend assessments in the morning, fasted ideally from food and fluid, ideally rested from exercise overnight or longer. We usually employ at least 24 hours of rest from exercise. If you follow all those items and assess the same way, same amount of clothing and so on, they can be relatively accurate. But yeah, all bioimpedance technologies work by just injecting small imperceptible currents through these electrodes that are in contact with your skin. For most InBodies, that's in your feet and your hands. And based on what the device knows it injected into your body and then what it receives back at the electrodes, it can get essentially an indication of how much that electrical signal, how easily that electrical signal traveled to your body, with the main idea being fat-free mass that we've talked to, because it possesses water. It conducts the electrical current more easily than fat mass, molecular fat mass, that will sort of impede this current. So that's the general principle. Some of these devices are great. InBody in general performs well. It's relatively well validated. Again, not perfect. And if there are unknown effects of these pharmaceuticals on relevant body compartments, fluid definitely relevant here. Yeah. It's possible you could be seeing things or not seeing things that could be somewhat a function of like physiological effects of these pharmaceuticals. Again, I'm uncertain on that, but
that's just interesting. Sometimes, we do see people, obviously it's a known side effect. These drugs can cause nausea, vomiting, and maybe decreased intake of fluid potentially. It's an interesting. Yeah,
that's why we caution again, about like dehydration. Spencer, just for what it's worth, I think the trial you're talking about, the one that was just published a month ago, compared tirzepatide reduces appetite, energy intake, fat mass. It was a secondary analysis of a randomized trial.
But wasn't it a phase one?
It doesn't say that. and it cites the previously published phase three trial of semaglutide versus tirzepatide. What it doesn't get into say is, was this a sub-analysis of that one? And they just, picked these people. It doesn't really get in. So I think we have to look at the supplementary index. Because I was aware of this small trial. I just thought it was a separate trial that they did. And it's, it may be a sub-analysis of that. Semaglutide versus tirzepatide.
Okay, Grant. Now here's the question: If you're doing a study and you go here's the worry. We want to make sure. And as my brother said, clinically these things are amazing drugs for the right person, the clinically indicated person, not super lean athletes and Hollywood stars that are just trying to lose 10 pounds.
And to be fair, Peter Attia, a lot of his patients might not need it. Right, yeah, seeing too many.
That's the concern.
Well,
I don't want to do that because that would get into slander, libel. I don't know. I can never remember.
Well, but it might be though. So if
it could be. It could be. I don't know if they're the correct patient. So anyway, we can. That's a potential. I'll just say. But if you're designing, I hope, and it looks like if there's anything, semaglutide versus tirzepatide. You have the head-to-head with the BODPOD data that's there in a very small thing. But based on not head-to-head, larger groups, it looks like, if anything, there is a potential for an extra catabolic effect from semaglutide or a change in fluid effects compared to the tirzepatide one that didn't have the lean body mass loss. So if you're designing a trial that would go like, okay, I want to know if this drug is truly catabolic, and I want to know muscle mass and not just kind of assume from a DEXA scan. How are you measuring that? How are you going to do that?
Yeah. So ideally you'd use whole body MRI.
Okay.
And not only would this allow you to look at the skeletal muscle itself, but it would allow you to look at other components that would mostly be grouped under fat-free mass that could be changing. So like organ mass, for example. And there's studies that have done this where they can tease out, it's like, okay, if we're seeing quote unquote lean loss or fat mass loss with substantial weight loss, where is this coming from? MRI can really answer that because it can look at all these relevant components separately at the organ tissue level. So we're looking at actual organs or tissues you could isolate anatomically, which is different than what we've been talking about so far, which is just kind of molecules of fat anywhere in the body, non-fat molecules anywhere in the body, and so on. So ideal whole body MRI. If that wasn't possible, you could do something just like segmental MRI or CT scan or peripheral quantitative CT, something that would allow you to at least check some representative muscle groups. You really could even do ultrasound. So in our lab, for example, we'll often do a four compartment model, which is molecular level. We're talking about just like molecules of, you know, fat, water, protein, and so on. But we'll pair that with ultrasound. So we're looking at representative muscle groups, checking the actual muscle thickness as just to help us interpret. So if we see an increase in fat-free mass, we're like, okay, that's good, but really we're interested in increasing muscle. So let's check these ultrasound data also. We also see increase in these specific muscle groups we're checking. That makes us feel more confident that we are seeing an increase in fat-free mass due to increases in muscularity, say in a training study.
That's so interesting. How much is a whole body MRI on a research scale compared to a DEXA scan?
How much does it cost?
Yeah.
So here, I think our MRI facility on campus, I think, is actually on the affordable side. And I know it's over $500 an hour to do the scan. I think it depends on the specific protocol, like how many slices you're taking and so on for how quickly you could do a whole body scan.
Okay.
So certainly, I'll put it in the more expensive realm. Many studies using MRI, it seems like it's essentially in a medical facility where they have kind of unique access or possibly are even conducting scans anyway and use that, paired with DEXA data as a way to make it into a body composition study.
Fascinating. Yeah. I think that's pretty cool. You're a wealth of knowledge here because you're going way beyond our expertise. I love it. I love it.
It's amazing.
I'm like,
it's
like
really
learning.
Cool. I mean, and that's the thing. I just don't think enough people are paying attention to these nuances that need to be paid attention to when they're interpreting these and then making huge, broad claims to a large,
which could be harmful
part of the population. Yeah, it's.
I mean, either way, I do think this needs to be studied more. I'm not going to say forget it, stupid, because there is
signal. We love muscle. We want muscle.
Okay,
here's good.
Okay, here's my anecdote of the patient. The highest that I saw was a 38% lean body mass loss, but their strength gains were, I'm not going to say extraordinary, but very good.
But they had to be lifting weights then.
They were.
Right.
But they still had a 38% lean body mass loss. So what Grant's saying is that fluid shifts, like some sort of fluid shifts. I don't know.
Something didn't make sense.
Is it possible they got stronger and still lost a lot of muscle?
Probably not.
I'm sure it's possible. One thing I'd mentioned that I don't think we've gotten into directly, but there are, if I was designing a study, like similar study, say in addition to using whole body MRI, there might be, or say you don't have access to that technique, there might be some merit to doing your baseline assessment, but then doing another assessment within a few weeks to a month, say like 1 to 4 weeks, because there are some relatively well-characterized kind of initial kind of rapid changes in weight loss where you would see kind of a higher proportion loss as fat-free mass, but this might largely be due to reduced glycogen that then stabilizes and the associated water that then stabilizes, as well as some early protein loss that could be some from skeletal muscle, some from other tissues. But I would personally be curious to see how much of this, if we're seeing this potentially notable lean mass loss after like a year or 2 years, how much of that was really rapid. And I don't know, I didn't see on there kind of the trajectory, if this is pretty linear on the weight loss or if it is pretty quick. If it's pretty linear, this may not be as much of an issue.
That's relatively linear. I mean, if we want to look at this good comparison that they just published a month ago that Spencer talked about, semaglutide versus tirzepatide. And again, it's only 1 milligram semaglutide, by the way. But, the weight loss was, a pretty linear weight loss over 28 weeks, over half of a year. And, and going back to that, Spencer, I mean, and that was the BOD pod one, the fat-free mass change in kilograms was only, it was 0.8 for semaglutide and 1.6 for tirzepatide compared to the negative 5.9, 9.7 respective kilograms of fat mass in that one.
Yeah.
I mean, anyways.
We are, and who is your mentor, you said?
Sorry, my mentor?
Yeah. Who's the godfather of...
So he didn't mentor me formally. I wish. He's great. Stephen Hamesfield.
Yeah.
He's just a giant in this field. So.
Yeah, he's a legend even to us. We don't do anything.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting. I mean, we're looking into figuring out how to do these trials because I just... My thing is this is a Docs Who Lift podcast. We want everybody to lift weights. We're shills, and so are you. So... But if we're thinking practically, not everybody is going to lift. So we do see a clinical benefit in these medicines for the right indicated person. But at the same time, hey, is there a concern for some of these other things? Because maybe they wouldn't be able to continue the medicine long term because of costs. And then are we setting these people up for something else down the line? We should study it. I don't think we should completely dismiss it. But I think this, I'm just trying to think of conceptually how this should be studied. And
yeah, and I think your anecdote about the strength, even though there was training, is important. Even in non-training individuals, if you could throw in some muscle function metrics, that would help a lot because again, there are some confusion or, you know, some muddy waters about this lean mass loss, especially if we're just doing a quad pod, something like that. Mm-hmm. But if you could see, it's like they're maintaining, maybe even improving, who knows, muscle function, but say even just hoping for maintaining muscle function through relevant indicators, you know, simple like grip strength and like rate of force development, some lower body testing and so on. I think that'd be a great way to complement the body comp side.
You know, that actually brings up another, you know, from my anecdotal experience with patients doing a ton of semaglutide, you know, and then tirzepatide just over the past year, you know, because I see a higher proportion of people with type 2 diabetes and more severe disease, usually older, oftentimes with heart disease, kidney disease, liver disease. And so they have severe obesity, right? They have real severe disease. They lose weight on semaglutide. Their sugars get better. They reduce their cardiovascular risk, all these things. Well, guess what else happens even if they're not into exercising per se as their weight goes down? I know Spencer knows the answer to this, but their non-exercise functional activity goes up all the time. So if they're losing a significant amount of lean muscle mass, I don't know because I don't do body composition on them. We're just doing clinical monitoring. But their physical activity and their exercise and their fitness does generally go up, even if they're not really trying per se. Of course, we're always encouraging them. But, you know, so I would say their functional status almost always improves too. So their clinical, you know, cardiometabolic health improves. Their functional status improves. And we have data to support that too, by the way. I mean, whether or not the body composition shows reduced muscle mass, but their functional status improves. Spencer, we have tons of data on semaglutide for improved functional status. Yeah. Maybe not strength per se, and that would be great, but you know, just general physical function is a really important aspect.
What about are you into the muscle quality? Like, cuz some people think that, like, sure, you can lose some muscle, but you actually are improving the quality of the fibers. Are you into any of that? Cuz that's, I got into this debate at the Obesity Week, Casey and the Dr. Jakisic was like, you know, I'm not so keen on who cares about some of the lean body mass losses, because maybe you can make the quality better at the same time, and that's more important mm-hmm. than the actual amount. I don't know. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, so we'll sometimes look at that from ultrasound. You could do that from other imaging techniques, not from like a whole body DEXA necessarily, but certainly from like MRI, CT, and ultrasound we can do that.
Do biopsies or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, you could do that. We do that some in our department. That's not my particular area.
It's not your expertise.
Of interest. Okay. I don't love it. But yeah, you could certainly look at that and actually look at, say, like lipid, I don't know, infiltration into the muscle.
Yeah.
But you can do that visually as well from these imaging techniques. And it is something that's relevant. I don't know if you'd have reduction. I'd have to look at that. I'm not certain if you could have a reduction of lipid content to the extent where it's like, yeah, you're truly like detectably losing mass here, mm-hmm. but improving quality. I think you certainly could see improvements in muscle quality, but I'm not sure. I think there'd be like some relationship between those two things, but not direct where it's
sometimes we can just see it. Like, you know, I look at Spencer sometimes and can tell his muscle quality is going down the tubes.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, Casey had extremely high muscle quality in utero. He doesn't even have to do anything anymore. He just walks around as huge.
I love what you all were saying about, or, Casey, what you were saying about the other metrics. I mean, I was lecturing on that this week in the context of athletes, saying that, like, because there are errors in every body composition method, there are assumptions, all of this, especially if you're looking at one individual. I always recommend being very cautious to make like what I'd call like a programming change based on that variable alone. So again, this was in the context of athletes, but we're saying if their performance is good, if subjectively they're feeling good, if like all these signals look positive, but you have a poor body comp result, you shouldn't like jump ship and change programs and be like, oh, yeah, we need to switch it all up because of that. And I feel like there are a lot of parallels there. You're like, okay, you know, maybe they have testing, maybe they don't, maybe it's just looking at these studies, but you're like, you know, I see the concern there, but all these other really important factors that we are evaluating, physical function, are improving. So I feel like that's a great case for being a little skeptical to go too far with jumping ship just due to body comp changes.
Right.
Yeah. This might have been my favorite podcast so far.
I mean, this was really insightful.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
Grant, you
are just like the man.
Yeah.
Like, because it just...
This is going to get uncomfortable. We're going to flatter you so much.
Yeah, if we were there in person, I don't know what would be going on here.
Nope, I just got fired again.
I'm teetering there.
Oh, yeah.
But seriously, thank you so much for coming on. Again, this offline, we'll be discussing possible research. We're discussing this as a team as well at my company. This needs to be addressed, needs mm-hmm. to be looked at. We're still not concerned clinically, but right. we think it does need to be studied. So.
Of course. And it's good to note. And we want people to lift weights. When in doubt, everyone, please resistance train, eat well, take your medicine if it's indicated.
Say your prayers, take your vitamins. Thanks so much for coming on and being the expert in this field.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Here's our outro. Everybody give this a share. If you heard anybody talking about lean mass losses and all that, this is the podcast that you need to listen
to. Send it to Megyn Kelly.
Let's put Grant on there. Let's just put it in.
Oh, yeah. Let's get Grant on Megyn Kelly. All right. Yeah, hurry. Somebody,
all right,
please.
All right. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.